From the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, this is Women at Work on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. Here are your hosts, Laura Zarrow and Melanie Katzman.
Welcome to Women at Work, everyone, here on Sirius XM Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. I'm Laura Zarrow, and I'm the Executive Director of Lifelong Learning. My trusty co-host, Melanie Katzman, is bringing her brilliance to Bermuda, and so she can't be with us today. But I'm looking forward to having her back next week as part of our ongoing conversation about how we help women join, stay, succeed, and lead in the workplace. Since the turn of the new year, we've been really focusing on what can we do to change ourselves? How do we start here with who we are and figure out how to make our lives what we want them to be? And we started with some of the basics that usually come with the turn of the new year, like how to manage our finances better, how do we spark the change that makes us fit and start an exercise plan. Last week, we actually spent a lot of time talking about how we remove our internal barriers to success, how we face the ways that we may be thinking we're imposters and not believing in ourselves. Today, we're actually going to start from that point and then turn it outwards and say, how can we believe in ourselves, package it, brand it, build it, and march it forward to make a real impact in the world? I'm delighted to welcome as our guest Amanda Miller Littlejohn, who is a bona fide expert in all of this. So, Amanda, thank you for coming up from D.C. We're delighted to have you here at Women at Work.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here with you today.
Well, before we get started with how we turn ourselves into our best brands, I want to share with our listeners who you are and how you got to be in this role.
Okay, perfect.
So you were once upon a time an English major, and then you started to put a brand in a box. How did you get from one to the other?
Wow, it's been an interesting ride. I started out, I always have been a writer. That's my passion, you know, and as I encourage people to always think back to childhood, what did they love to do early on? That was what I loved to do early on, writing. And so I majored in English just because that's what I knew I loved, and I didn't know where it would take me, but I ended up doing a stint in journalism, which led to PR and communications, which has ultimately led me to my current role as a personal branding coach and strategist for everyday people who want to broadcast their brilliance and package their genius for the world.
So most people would not connect the dots in a straight line to go from English major to brand builder.
Yes.
But I see a theme between these things.
Ah, do tell.
That might have something to do with storytelling.
Yes, that's true. That's definitely true. I think one of my gifts is being able to tell stories, but also hear the story that you are telling that you can't hear for yourself. And so I lean a lot on my years as a journalist to really listen intently when people are describing their ups, their downs, the different jobs that they've had, and what excites them about the roles that they've had, so that I can kind of clue in and tune into, you know, what could their future brand, their next step be like? Like, what is the work that they absolutely love to do?
So your storytelling starts with good listening.
Yes, yes, yes. I think all storytelling kind of starts there.
So I'm gathering. As a journalist, though, mm-hmm. You are listening for the specific purpose of reporting. Mm-hmm. When you are listening to start doing PR work, how is that the same or different?
It is. There are a lot of parts of it that are the same. When you're listening as a journalist, you're trying to paint a picture of the story. And essentially, you're doing the same thing for PR. For personal branding, which is essentially, I think, PR for the individual, what I'm listening for are, I'm listening to hear the person come alive. I'm listening for that spark when they start telling me, you know, they go on and on and on about their history, and then there's a moment where we go down this road, and they're telling a specific story about a specific project or role, and they get excited, they light up, their energy shifts, and you can feel, whether if I'm talking to them on the phone, you can feel that energy shift, and if we're in person, you can see them kind of come alive. And I'm always waiting for that moment to see the person come alive, because to me, that is a clue to what they were born to do. And so getting them to be able to see that, and they'll always say, oh my God, I hadn't thought about that in a long time, or wow, I haven't talked about this in a while. And it just gets those wheels turning, because once you're in that space, you're, you know, you can get there much quicker.
So what you're listening for aren't just the facts of this is who I am and this is where I want to go. It's about something more intangible, but kind of more essential.
Right. So there's a book called Do More Great Work by Michael, and I'm going to mess his name up, Stangier, S-T-A-N-G-I-E-R. And he kind of describes the feeling that I'm looking for in that book of peak moments when people are describing their past projects, you know, things that they've done either for pay or as in a volunteer role, or just things that they came up with. Maybe it's just the act of sitting by a window and writing, you know, writing an essay that no one will ever see. But when it gives you that feeling of excitement and energy and you're physically energized, people most likely are physically energized when they retell those stories and they recount those experiences. And so that's what I'm looking for.
So when do you have flow?
Yes, exactly, exactly. That's so funny. I read Flow in high school. I know that's weird, right? Like, why was I reading psychology? But yeah, I read Flow. And so it's funny because now that you bring that up, I hadn't thought about that in a long time.
Well, when we look at our lives retrospectively, they make sense in a way.
Right.
They didn't in the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the moment for you? When did you figure out that you were going to make a shift from PR into building your own business?
So, well, I had a business, a PR business, before I made the shift to personal branding, but it was kind of a gradual shift. What happened was, you know, as I was doing work for nonprofits and companies and kind of larger organizations, working on their social media campaigns, media relations, et cetera, communications, I would get individuals who would have, you know, a small business, or they were a service provider, a lawyer, a consultant, you know, a beautician, you know, they were a massage therapist. They had a small enterprise. They had a service that they sold one-to-one to customers. And they would come to me and say, you know, I need the stuff that you give your big clients. Like, I need to know about social media and getting my name out there, and the world doesn't know, not enough people know about me and the amazing work that I do, because I'm great at what I do, but I'm just kind of under a rock. No one knows about me. And so I would turn them away because I didn't have anything in my business model that was suited for the individual.
Well, since you're here today, we actually do have the opportunity for you to answer some of those questions. So if you have a question about how you can best represent yourself and put your best you out there, give us a call. Our number is 1-844-942-7866. That's 1-844-WHARTON. You can also write to us at businessradio@siriusxm.com. That's businessradio@siriusxm.com. Or you tweet at BizRadio 111. We'd love to hear from you. And if you're listening to us during replay, which will happen over the next few days and over the weekend, just because you may not be listening to us live doesn't mean you shouldn't write in. We would love to hear your questions, and we'll make sure we bring it up on next week's show. So with that said, let's go back to this. You were, obviously people were realizing that you had some magic superpowers and there was a need that they had to figure out how to move forward to what they wanted to do.
Right, right.
So, but you're still working full time in PR.
Yes, yes. But I was, you know, it's so funny. I do everything kind of backwards. I was building my brand and I was doing it. I didn't call it building my brand, but when I started out in PR and I intentionally made that shift from journalism. You know, I was starting out in a town in Washington, D.C., where there's a ton of PR people, PR consultants, communications people, public affairs. It's a ton of people. So it was a really saturated market. So I said, well, if I'm going to survive this industry as a newcomer, nobody knows who I am, I'm going to have to get out there and stand out and make a name for myself. So I started blogging. I started doing webinars and trainings and getting invitations to share information on how to best
now, when you started
media.
To do this, did you just seize the opportunities that came your way? Or did you think strategically about how to get yourself out there?
It was a mix of thinking strategically and making my own opportunities. So it's not my personality to wait for anything to fall into my lap. If I want something, I want an opportunity, I want something to happen, I will make it happen. If I want a platform, I create a platform if no one is coming to me to offer me one. But In its simplest form, I was a writer. I had a journalism background. I love to write. I'm the type of person that if I don't write, I get cranky. And so I started this blog because I would be cranky if I didn't write.
Okay, it was like your therapy and your exercise. It was therapy,
but it was also a way for me to showcase my expertise around social media and to share my journey as this new PR consultant in Washington, D.C. And so, you know, I wrote good stuff, good content, and people would approach me to, I guess, pick my brain and get more information, and then the invitations for the webinars and the speaking and that sort of thing happened. I wasn't planning on that. I was just planning to write my blog, but it led to other stuff.
So you were doing something mostly because it was good for you.
Yes.
And not in a, I'm going to leverage this, but because it was cathartic for you to write.
It was cathartic, but I also did intentionally say that, you know, most of the PR people at that time didn't have blogs. They just helped their clients. And so I said, well, this will be one way that I can stand out because other people aren't doing it. So I did intentionally think of it that way. I didn't know that it would lead to everything that it led to after that point. So I think that's also just a good point to start with your own innate talent or skill. So if I hadn't been a great writer, maybe I could have, you know, started speaking or hosting workshops from the beginning because that was my strength.
But the same storyteller in you that majored in English in college was still telling stories.
Right.
And now it was coming out through your own writing in a blog.
Exactly.
But that's bringing you attention and exposure to people that you couldn't necessarily find or reach otherwise.
Exactly. I met a lot of people, a lot of friends, clients, new colleagues, and basically built my network on the back of that blog because I was kind of an unknown. And then I started blogging, and you have this potential to reach the world if your stuff is good and people are sharing it. And so that's kind of what happened.
So at this point, you've got a full-time job in PR.
Mm-hmm.
You're blogging like mad.
Mm-hmm.
How much time does this take? How hard is it to set up your own blog?
At the time when I was blogging very heavily, my goal was to blog daily. So I had an editorial calendar, which you may have seen in the branding boxes. I mentioned kind of what my calendar was for the week.
But tell our listeners, how did you structure your time so that you built this into our life?
So I'm trying to think. At that time, my kids were very young. So I had babies.
And how many babies do you have?
I have two babies.
Okay.
Well, they're not babies anymore. But at the time, they were babies. So this was when they were 1 and 2, 2 and 3, 3 and 4.
So you're working full time.
I've got the kids. So I would squeeze it in the morning over coffee, in the evening. And it just would depend on if I had something really good that hit me, like I could crank it out quickly. And sometimes I would write content that wasn't time sensitive. So it's what I call evergreen content. And I could kind of schedule it to go out, you know, because I know I'm going to be busy on Thursday. So let me just write something extra and schedule this for then to post. So I made it work. And I think if I hadn't been passionate about it and I hadn't loved it, I would not have. But because I am passionate and was passionate and it energized me, I mean, you know, you make time for you find the time to do the things that make you feel amazing, right?
Right, or that adage, you have something to do, give it to a busy person.
Mm-hmm,
they'll
mm-hmm.
get it done. But one of the things that I see happen often with the endeavors that we do because we love them is that we can tend to lose ourselves in them, get distracted by them, or become perfectionists.
Hmm.
How did you make sure that you adhered to a standard but that it didn't take over your life?
That's a good question. Only later did I find out, I did the Strengths Finder and found out my 5 strengths, and one of them is achiever. And so one of the hallmarks of that strength profile is you like a sense of things getting done. So not just the act of doing them, but you like to be able to cross things off
list. So getting it done trying to make it perfect won't get in the way of getting
exactly.
it done, which is a really important a guidepost to have
right.
as you're working on these things, because you can't fuss over them forever.
I mean, I love, and I'm a perfectionist. I have perfectionist tendencies, but I mean, there were typos on my blog. I mean, and I would go back and correct them. But to me, it was more important, especially once my readership grew and people would say, oh my God, that post really helped me. I thought, you know, it's not about me and the typo. It's about this information and this helping someone and giving someone the clarity that they need. So I need to get over myself.
Well,
and press publish.
I also think that's freeing for our listeners. Mm-hmm. I'm talking with Amanda Miller-Littlejohn, who's a PR expert, a personal branding coach, and the founder of Package Your Genius Academy. Mm-hmm. And in all of my, everything I've read about you, my looking at the Build Your Brand in a Box, you're a consummate professional. Mm-hmm. It's actually freeing to hear that you took your professional skill set, brought it to an act like blogging, but you stayed in the moment. You mm-hmm. remembered what was most important, which was timely posts, relevant content, right. well expressed, and you didn't beat yourself up, as we learned when we talked about the imposter syndrome last week,
yes.
for small
I love
errors.
That book, actually.
You just corrected them and marched on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so at this point, you're now blogging, you've got your young kids. Mm-hmm. How'd you make your next shift?
So, again, I started getting inquiries from individual service providers and small business owners, people who were too small for my current suite of services.
Okay.
Because all I had at that time was, you know, the retainer model. And they would say, I just need ideas. I really need some help. I really, you know, would love you to help me figure out what's my social media strategy, because maybe they'd come to a workshop that I'd hosted or someone had hosted me at or heard me on a webinar. And so they wanted me to help them with their business.
And how long ago was this? What year was this?
This was 2010, okay. 2011. So I was getting the inquiries starting around 2009. So 2009 to 2011, I was getting the inquiries. But I didn't really take them seriously and say, I'm going to create something for this market until about 2011. Yeah. And so I decided, you know, I think as any business person would say, I mean, we're here at Wharton, you know that. Like, when you hear a problem so many times, it's time to address that problem. Like, that's a market that's begging to be served. And so I said, well, how can I serve this market at, you know, and give them something that fits their budget, but also, you know, doesn't take a ton of my time, because obviously they can't afford the retainer. So I started doing strategy sessions for individuals. And it was very, very well received.
So there was actually an important catalyst in your life that made you shift from journalism into PR full-time.
Yes.
That happened a little before this, right?
Yeah, that happened before.
I also, if you don't mind, I want to take that step backwards, because I think it was really important.
Okay.
What happened in your life that made you make such a big shift?
So I had my first child, Logan, and I, during my maternity leave, I was essentially laid off from my newspaper job. So, I mean, they didn't say you're fired, but they said, we're making a round of cuts, so what are you thinking? Because we can't fire you, but we just want to know, what are you thinking? And so, at the time, I was ready to make a shift because, number one, I wanted to earn more income, and I knew that I could outside of the newsroom, and I just wanted to flex my entrepreneurial muscles because I had them, and now I have this new motivation of a child. And so that was kind of the catalyst, because I was already kind of on a break trying to figure out my next move, charting out what's next.
Now, did you have somebody else in your support network? Do you have a partner?
My husband, yes.
Okay. Mark. So was it that you had somebody who could be your anchor while you were doing this?
Absolutely not.
What happened?
Well, that's the juicier part of the story. So it's so funny. So I'm at home. Maternity leave. I had Logan. Logan was 3 weeks old, and my husband came home, and he was acting very strange. He wasn't talking, and this was our first baby, so we were just everything strange. No, we were just so excited about Logan. Every little thing was so exciting. Like, oh my God, he pooped. Look it up.
Right.
And he was quiet and just more subdued than normal. And it took until Sunday for me to get it out of him that he had been laid off.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so I absolutely
not. So now you're
not,
both out of work with a brand new baby.
Exactly. And so that's probably the scariest time to start your own business. But for some reason, I think I looked at the situation differently. I thought that if two people who have a newborn, not even a month old child, can lose their employment, this world is not set up to take care of people. So we may as well, you know, forge our own paths and take care of ourselves. So what can I do? I know I'm never going to let myself or my family down. I'm never going to fire myself, right? So why don't I create my own source of income so that I'm depending on my own drive and energy and ability to make things happen, to put food on the table, versus whether or not, you know, this nonprofit is funded this year.
So at a moment when it seems like the bottom just drops out from under you, life couldn't be more complex.
Right.
You just start your own business.
Yeah, I mean, you make it sound so easy. It was hard. It was scary. I'm not going to lie and say that it was easy, and, you know, but I think that I just had, it's the same thing, like, when I was a little girl and I would write poems and write essays and write in my journal, I always thought I had something important to say, and I always knew that someday other people would know that too, but I just knew it. No one had to tell me. I knew it. And so that was a similar situation. I just knew that I could do this. Like, I knew that I had the skills, the talents that a certain market needed and could pay for. And then if I push hard enough, I should be able to make something happen. And so, you know, it didn't take that long to prove myself right. I mean, within 4 months or so, I had landed a contract that essentially tripled the income that I had when I was a journalist. And I was working part-time at home.
So if we look at the components of this, because mm-hmm. this is in a way the opposite of what we talked about last week with the imposter syndrome, which is our greatest fears, mm-hmm. where we don't have faith in ourselves, and even in the presence of tremendous opportunities, we may not seize the day because we're too frightened to fail. This was the absolute opposite. Mm-hmm. You had really, professionally, not much left to lose at this point. to say that there were fabulous opportunities on the plate, aside from parenting and having yeah. a loving relationship at home, it was a blank slate. But because you were strengthened, motivated by a deep belief in yourself, mm-hmm. you just, you know, rolled up your sleeves and went to it.
I did.
But you did it in an extremely thoughtful and methodical way. Mm-hmm. So what were the steps that you took?
So from that period, the first thing I did, I assessed my skills and I decided on a market that I felt was the lowest hanging fruit. So I was a writer working in Washington, D.C. There were a lot of small PR firms, small public affairs firms, smaller shops that might land a big government contract or other contract. And instead of hiring full time people, because the contract may be for 3 or 4 months, they would need help. And so I created a 2-page PDF that described me, my capabilities, my credibility, and some sample things that I could help you out with writing-wise. And I shipped it. I mean, I sent it to everyone I knew.
And did you just send it? Now, did you send it hard copy or via email?
No, I sent an email PDF. So okay. I sent the PDF so they could open it up, print it out if they wanted to, but most importantly so that they could share it, and so they could forward it to other people.
Now, to me, no details are unimportant. So when you did this, was it on letterhead?
So I actually designed the two-pager, and I have it somewhere. I'll email it to you so you can see it later. But it was cute. It was a picture of me. I know. I was like 26. It was a picture of me.
Oh, wait. Time out for a moment. So you were also only 26 when you were doing this.
Yeah, I was 26. This was, yeah. Logan was born. This was before Connor, so I was 26.
Okay.
Yeah.
A very young person, but clearly very mature and
very old. I've always been old.
Okay, so you had a picture of yourself, but you took the time to think about the visual presentation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I did. It was a very creative presentation. It was like bright and red. It was a picture of me standing from a trip that I took to Rome. So I was standing in like a square with an umbrella over my shoulder, and you could clearly tell it was Europe. And I think my messaging was essentially a creative, worldly approach to words and language. And so I was trying to communicate that, yes, I'm this writer, but I'm a creative person, and I felt like it would connect with people who liked to travel and who felt sophisticated and worldly too. And people loved that thing. It was very eye-catching. So they would always do a double take and look at it again. And then my husband, he has a great network, and he sent it to everyone he knew, and he was always telling people. So together we were just this little team telling everybody, hire Amanda, she's a great writer. And it worked.
So when you sent out these cold emails, because I just want to make sure that when people want to do this in their own worlds, so they wrote a prop. How did you treat the email to which it was attached so that it would be read and appropriate?
Right. So I started out with people I knew. I didn't start out cold. I started out with people who I had worked for, worked with, worked under, who knew of me, who maybe professors, just people who I felt were I mean, people who I, because again, I had been a journalist, so I had interviewed a lot of people and I knew a lot of people. So that kind of, I came to the table with a nice network from just all the interviewing I had done too. And so.
And so that wasn't just an audience. That's an audience who will recognize your name, mm-hmm. open your email,
exactly.
whom you can address directly.
Right. So it wasn't, you know, these aren't best friends, but these are professional colleagues, people who know me and, you know, respected me or at least knew my name, remembered me. And so I started out by, I didn't do a hard ask, like, will you hire me? I simply told them my situation and that I was currently offering, you know, contract copywriting services, communications services to small nonprofits, small PR firms, or, you know, individual business owners who might need an extra writer. Do you know of anyone who may need this? If so, I'm attaching this document. Please feel free to share it with people in your network. So some of those people ended up needing what I did, but because it wasn't a direct ask, I think it kind of made the conversation easier to have.
That's the trick, I think.
Yeah.
That as I'm listening to you describe it, you hit a sweet spot where it was totally professional. Mm-hmm. It arrived in their mailboxes, almost irresistible not to open it.
Right.
But at the same time, you gave them, you presented yourself without cornering them into doing anything.
Exactly.
It's not like you showed up in their office. It's not like you got them on the phone. They could either act or not.
Right.
And no one lost face.
Right.
But it still entered their consciousness.
It still did. And even though a lot of people didn't necessarily act immediately when I sent it to them, months later, it would resurface. Someone would email me and attach the document that I had sent out and say, my friend Joe over at the department of whatever shared your name with me. I got a lot of those calls. People would say, someone shared your name with me and they said that you're a writer. So it didn't necessarily happen overnight, but because I had sent that document out into the universe, it, when it got to
almost
the right
like
person,
a chain letter, you
right.
put it out there, and then over time, it just started to come back.
It started to come back.
So you also saw that it was being read, it was being
it
shared,
was being
it was
read,
doing
shared,
what you intended
exactly.
it to do.
It was being printed and passed off to people. It was really cool.
How many did you send out?
Oh, gosh, that's a hard one. I would probably say I personally maybe sent out 200. My husband probably sent out as many, if not more. He was always bringing me up in conversation or just in email. He still does to this day. I'm like, Mark, I don't do, you can't just insert me into, no, you need to talk to my wife. She's awesome. She can help you. So he did that a lot. He went to a lot of networking stuff. And we lived in D.C., so there's a lot going on at any given time. And so there are a lot of opportunities to meet new people and share with new people. So I didn't just rely on email. I went out. I would go to networking receptions and different events. I'd try to go at least twice a week in the evenings to meet people, to pass out my card, and just, you know, get that FaceTime. And so I think that was effective as well.
This awesome woman that Mark says is his awesome wife is also Amanda Miller Littleton, personal branding coach and founder of the Package Your Genius Academy. When we come back, we're going to be talking more about how you can package your own genius. And if you have a question about how you can best represent yourself and put your best you out there, give us a call. Our number is 844-942-7866. We'll be back in a minute.
You're listening to Women at Work on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School, Sirius XM 111. Here again are Laura Zarrow and Melanie Katzman.
Welcome back to Women at Work, everyone, and our ongoing conversation about how to help women join, stay, succeed, and lead in the workplace. I'm Laura Zarrow, Executive Director of Lifelong Learning, and my trusty co-host, Melanie, is on her way to Bermuda. Be brilliant there. Look forward to her returning next week. In the meanwhile, I've had the great pleasure of talking with Amanda Miller Littlejohn. Amanda is a personal branding coach and the founder of the Package Your Genius Academy. She's a storyteller, a great listener, and an incredibly inspiring role model, as we've learned. Amanda was sharing her story with us in the first half of the show about a critical moment in her life. And it just amazed me. So, Amanda, welcome back, first
of all.
Thank
you. Thank you.
When we were talking about this moment where you had been working full-time as a journalist for a newspaper, mm-hmm. you were on maternity leave, mm-hmm. and you were laid off
mm-hmm.
at the same time that your husband lost his job.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a uniquely terrifying time.
Yes, it is.
And while it wasn't easy, you seized the moment and created your own whole business and turned your world around.
Mm-hmm.
In doing so, you found parts of yourself that you knew you could rely on. How did you have a sense of what you could do and that you could do something this enormous?
I don't think I knew at the time that I could do anything bigger than what I knew at the moment, right? Like, it sounds enormous now looking back to it, but essentially I've only built layers and layers upon that first layer, which was I knew I could write.
Okay.
I knew I could write, so I started with that. And I pushed that and hustled that and got in front of people and got them to show me or give me, you know, work around writing. And what happened was people just assumed I could do other things. And they would pull me into bigger projects, event planning, pitching the media. And I kind of learned as I was challenged. I rose to the occasion. And so that's how I think the suite of services kind of emerged, because people asked me to do things. And I'm not the type of person to say I can't do that. I'm like, I wonder if I can do that. And I go get a book and I learn and I read and I study and I figure out if I can do it. Obviously, some things, you know, you decide, no, I'm not going to try to go in that direction. But a lot of things I discovered just by being presented with the challenge and the opportunity.
It sounds like something that we can also apply in multiple areas of our lives. Yes. I often, as Melanie will tease me, come up with running and exercise metaphors.
Okay.
So when I was not at all physically active until I was in my mid-40s. And then
wow.
One day I just started walking. My doctor said, triple your exercise. I said, are you crazy? She goes, how much are you doing? I said, not
None.
Much. She said, it won't be hard to triple it.
Right.
So I figured, what can I do that's still better than doing nothing? I walked, and I got up and I walked for 20 minutes a day, 3 days a week. And then I tripled it. And I was going longer, and I was going farther. And within a year, I ran my first race.
Wow.
Within a year and a half, I ran my first half marathon. But it was the same. And I started it without those ambitions.
Right,
Let's
you didn't
just
think
get
of the marathon, right.
But I think there's something similar there.
I would agree.
Which is start with your core strength.
Mm-hmm.
Build on it.
Right.
And don't be afraid if it hurts a little bit, if it's new to you.
Mm-hmm.
And take the new things on kind of one at a time.
Exactly. I think that's very daunting and overwhelming to think, I want to run a marathon. No, I want to walk for 20 minutes. That's much more doable.
Right, exactly.
Right? And then when we master that, then we can add another 20 minutes and then keep going. And so I think, and I advise people too, when they are first kind of striking out to build something new or go in a different direction with their career or their business, they have this, I want a multi-million-dollar company and I want to travel the world speaking on stages. And I said, okay, let's find a local stage that you can speak from. You know, let's make, you know, $10,000 first and then grow that to 100 and then keep going. But I think if you try to tackle it and you look at it as this huge, huge, big thing, it is overwhelming and daunting. So for me, I just try to start small and build from there.
Because also, you can start at any point, right?
Yeah.
Do you need an event, something special to make you start, or can you just decide?
You just decide. And I think another thing about starting small, and I think you might agree with your exercise and activity, is when you master those teeny steps, you get so much confidence.
Oh,
because
it's
you
true.
Didn't even know you could do that. And so you're like, oh my God, well, what else can I do? I didn't know I could walk for 20 minutes.
Right.
Let's do 25.
Right.
And it just keeps growing. You get your own momentum, and that just, you know, challenges you and pushes you and energizes you. I keep going back to that energize.
No, it's so true, and you put it beautifully. When you see yourself start to learn and grow and improve simply by putting the effort in each day,
mm-hmm.
I find that's the biggest motivation to keep doing it.
It is.
Because where, as you put it, something can seem daunting. Yes, I'm, you know, going to be Queen of the May.
Right.
It's easier if you just say, I'm going to take this first step, make some progress towards it. And the finding the stick-to-itiveness,
mm-hmm.
the diligence in yourself
mm-hmm.
to make that small goal happen is easier when you keep that goal manageable.
Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is, when you set out to achieve smaller goals, a lot of times you'll inadvertently uncover a new goal that you didn't even know, or an interest, right? Like you said, you started walking and then you did a race. I mean, I'm sure you weren't thinking races when you started walking.
I didn't even think I would ever run.
And now that's a thing.
Right. And
it's
then,
like your thing.
And then I also entered my first triathlon.
Exactly.
Because I realized I shouldn't run every day, but now I was so excited about doing something every day that I started a cross train.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody said, you're swimming, you're running, you're biking. What happens if you put them all together? But it's not dissimilar to what you were talking about. Start with core strength.
Mm-hmm.
Start with a core goal.
Mm-hmm.
And then build on step by step, being aware of the fact that you're building it deeper and more broad as you go.
Right. And I think the biggest thing, too, is just to start stepping. Right?
Start. Yes.
Like, take a step, but start.
Don't be afraid.
Yeah, you just have to do something, if no matter how small it is, because I think the act of motion and movement and moving towards something, it gets us going and thinking and our wheels turning, and we evolve once we start moving. But you can't do that until you take that first step.
Well, speaking of taking your first step, mm-hmm. I took a look at your Build Your Brand, Pursue Your Pursue Your Passions, Package Your Genius. It's a kit.
So the branding box. This is what this is called.
The branding box.
The branding box, yes.
It actually does give you a methodical process
mm-hmm.
to start, take the first step,
mm-hmm.
and build the light, the you want to be.
Mm-hmm.
So while I was looking through it, I was so inspired because it's a combination of things. There's a very clear methodology to what are the components of building your brand.
Right.
And I have to admit, when I came into this, every time I hear the concept, your personal brand, it makes me a little uncomfortable.
Why is that?
Like, there's something artificial about it, something I'm slapping on myself, an identity I want to have that may not
be me. That you don't have, right.
But then I started to look at what you've shared in your box, and I realized I've got it all wrong. Where do you start?
So to me, that's a great question. I believe my personal branding philosophy is that everyone's brand, their true brand, originates in their natural strengths, their innate strengths, and those strengths can be detected in early childhood around the age 7, 8, 9, 10, the things that you gravitated towards. Like I told you, I was a writer. I've always been a writer. Some people, you know, you can notice, oh my God, this is such a bossy kid, or this kid's a leader, or
right.
he's a daredevil, or, you know, she just always knows what to do, and she's always making good decisions.
Or she's a creative thinker.
And so I've studied that a lot to kind of inform the tools that I've created through the branding box and my other services and products. But StrengthsFinders 2.0 was extremely helpful to me.
What is StrengthsFinder?
It's a test that was created, a personality and strengths assessment that's managed by the Gallup people, the people who do the Gallup poll. So they kind of own the software and technology. But you can get the book anywhere, StrengthsFinders 2.0.
Is it expensive?
I think the book is $20, but you can go online and do the test for $9.99.
And find out what you're good at.
Find out what your five core strengths are.
That sounds like a pretty high value.
It is. And so there's 37 strengths, and you find out what are your top five. And the basic premise is if you know what your top five strengths are, you can build on what you're good at. But you can't really build on, you can only improve so much the things that you aren't good at, but you can really take into the stratosphere the things that you're naturally good at.
So while you can always grow, you can always mm-hmm. compensate for weaknesses and develop in new ways, the trick is to find these core strengths that you have.
And build on those.
Because
you can truly be exceptional in those areas. You can't be exceptional in the things that you aren't really that good at, but you're trying to improve. You can become okay and competent.
Right.
But you can only be exceptional in the things that you're naturally good at. And then you find other people who are good in the other areas and surround yourself with them so that, you know, you don't have to be great at everything.
You used language in the materials that I found really disarmed me. Because as I said, I went in a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, guard up.
Am I going to put on a brand? But what you really talked about was self-reflection and authenticity.
Yes.
And I love the way that you've put it, that if you want to be exceptional at something, you have to start at your own strengths.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like it's about more than just aptitude. Mm-hmm. It's also about what's going to motivate you or interest you. Or it does, is that an important part of this or not?
I think that goes back to those peak moments, you know, where you get your natural energy. And, you know, people always say, if you could do something all day and you weren't going to get paid for it, what would you be doing? Like, what are you passionate about? Like, what lights you up and get would get you out of bed even if there was no paycheck involved? And so to me, if you couple that with natural talent and ability and skill set, I mean, that makes for a pretty sweet, you know, scenario.
That's
for
a powerful
work. It's very powerful. It's very powerful. And I think that when we're passionate about the work that we do, you know, it's not work. Like for me, I just moved into an office. I shared this on Facebook the first week in January. And I remember when I had a job, I think of this every day as I drop the kids off and I drive to my office. I remember when I had a job in my early 20s and they said, you've got to be at work by 10. I could never get there by 10. I would always be like 10:07, 10:23. But now there's no one there who's waiting for me to get there. It's just me. Right? And I'm always there
about
it. I'm there at like 8:55. Like, I can't wait to get there to see what's going to happen today. And I'm passionate about it. It doesn't feel like work. It's my own thing. And I love it. I love what I do. I love how I'm able to connect with my clients and help them have those moments. That's really, really powerful.
See, the intrinsic motivation here is on multiple levels. You're clearly doing something you love and enjoy.
Yes.
You're making an impact. And
yes.
It's also your own business. So you have ownership of
That's true. I do have ownership. But I think even if Amanda Miller Littlejohn wasn't the company where the checks went and I was going to do the same work for someone else, it's still powerful to have someone call you or have someone come to your office and within a 2-hour time frame they have a completely new outlook on their own capabilities, possibilities, and what they could be or do. It is addictive to see that spark and to see them just get a new lease on life and to get validation about all their silly thoughts and ideas and to get a strategy to make things happen, to go from, I have this crazy idea that I think I want to try, to walk out with, okay, my first step is this. It's just so powerful to see people empowered to be, to step into a new vision for themselves and to step into a bigger vision for themselves.
Well, and one of the things that's so powerful about what you've done, and particularly with the brand in the box, is that people can go through that process even without the great benefit of being in the office with you for two hours.
That's true.
I have to tell you, I sat down and I started to read. So the brand in the box includes...
The branding box.
I'm sorry. The
branding box.
You're right, because
I don't want people Googling the brand in a box.
The branding box. And it's branding. A process more than it's a thing.
Yes.
And so it comes with a notebook of exercises and mm-hmm. principles.
A binder, yep.
Yep. And I am particularly charmed by the little book of brand lessons.
Yes.
Because as I was reading it, I was getting inspired. There were things in here that you put in such an engaging way. Mm-hmm. One of them, if I may quote,
Please.
Was under Carpe Diem. I want you to act boldly, unreasonably, daily. Stop overthinking your dreams. Stop being so rational. And then when
I wrote that? No.
Somebody did.
No, I didn't.
And then when I opened up the quarterly brand outlook, so there's a planning calendar that comes with it. In it, it was, what is your big, hairy, audacious quarterly goal?
Mm-hmm.
I loved that. So there's a message that's coming through here of you can do this and think big.
Right. Stop playing it so safe, because I think especially, and I think it's appropriate for women at work, women especially, I find, we play it so safe and we're so afraid to think big and put ourselves out there in a way that I think comes more naturally to men. But one of the things that I'm so adamant about, women claiming their expertise, you know, you said, oh, I don't want to put on this brand. We're so modest in many cases when we don't need to be modest. Like, we're rock stars. We're amazing, doing amazing things, have done amazing things, but yet we're like, oh, I just do that little thing on the side sometimes.
That
maybe,
little
kind
totally
of.
Awesome, right. Empowering thing that affects people's
but
lives.
But I think we're doing ourselves a disservice by being so modest and by thinking so small, because number one, that's not good for our confidence and our sense of self-esteem. But number two, other people can't
get the impact that we could make if they don't know what we're doing.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, this came up in talking about, you know, the flip side of the coin of when we feel like we can't do it, when we think we're being imposters, mm-hmm. we're actually denying the world our best selves.
Right.
We have things to contribute, and we have to start by thinking that we can.
Exactly.
And in the branding box, the mm-hmm. message is all through it. And in fact, there were kind of core concepts mm-hmm. that you have listed in it that I found fascinating kind of as a package. The first one was you are an expert.
Yep.
Are you an expert in everything?
No. You are not, but there is something that you do in a way that no one else can do it as well as you do. And I think one of the challenges or the journeys of life is to figure out, you know, what your expertise is, what your zone, when you're in your zone, what is your genius.
And we happen to be talking with Amanda Miller Littlejohn, who is in her zone helping other people find their genius. Are there steps that you can take? Because there are exercises
yes.
that come with this. So what would you recommend or ways to go forward in figuring out what am I an expert in?
So I think one of the first things that you want to do is sit down to, you know, take an hour or two and really reflect on, you know, write on a piece of paper all the jobs that you've had in your career. And then for each of those jobs, write down your favorite projects, assignments. You know, where did you shine? Where did you really showcase your brilliance? Where did you feel like you were using all of your talents, right? You know, sometimes we come to work and we feel like, oh, I'm using 20% of myself, but there's so much more of me. But when did you feel like every single ounce of your talents, experience, your gifts, your knowledge, everything was working together to create this amazing
when you
outcome?
Rocked it, when you used
yeah, like you, there was nothing
all the
left.
Parts of yourself.
There was nothing left. When did you feel like that? And those moments are peak moments, and they kind of point to what not only can you do and what not only are you good at doing, but what you were born to do.
And this is different than looking at your resume, because this isn't
exactly.
about what your obligations were.
No. It's this not is your job title. It's not the job description. It is, even if it was a project that was outside of your job description, and a lot of times people will volunteer on projects within different departments, or they may have a volunteer experience or fundraising experience that isn't even a part of their regular, you know, daily job description. But that is the thing that, oh my God, if I could do this every day, I would do this every day. Like, you want to try to pull out those moments. And then once you've pulled those out, if you can, try to find the common themes, right? So was it that you were leading the team? Was it that you were coming up with a strategy for the team to execute? You know, was it that you were thinking creatively or on a national scale? You know, was it that you were working with women and you were meeting with them every day and you were able to kind of create a social environment along with the work?
So
figure out what the themes are.
So, but in doing that, really think about the experience first.
Yes.
So not the outcome.
No.
But because you said things like, was I working with a group of X type of people?
Mm-hmm.
Was I trying to solve a certain kind of problem?
Mm-hmm.
So that you can conjure the emotion.
Exactly.
Rather than just the facts.
Right.
Okay.
Because people complete projects all the time and they hated it. They hated that experience.
Right.
The project was great. They got, you know, they increased revenue or whatever.
And it was a fabulous success, but they were miserable.
They
while
were
they
miserable.
Did it.
And I never advocate for people to recreate miserable experiences, even if, you know, you didn't make any money. If you felt great and you felt alive, let's follow that trail. Let's see where that goes, because I'll bet that if we stay on it long enough, we will find a place where, you know, the passion and the income meet.
In the binder.
Yes.
There was an interesting set of exercises that I was surprised to find there where you had to identify, I thought it was powerful, you would identify, it seemed like barriers. What were the things that were getting in the way of your moving forward?
Right,
why
right.
did you include that there? And how'd you come up with that list?
So that list has evolved over the last 3 years, just from, you know, after I started doing those strategy sessions with individuals who wanted my help, I started to notice that it wasn't always just a very tactical conversation. It wasn't just, how do I get media interviews? How do I, you know, create a strategy for social media? A lot of times the things that were holding the people back were internal things. Like, they had these stories playing in their heads that made no sense, right? Or
they didn't want to launch. They didn't want to move because I would push them. You know, I want you to start doing this today. Let's launch this today. Let's plan the event tomorrow. And they'd be like, oh, well, I don't know. And I would keep digging because I'm the reporter. I'm trying to get to the bottom of things. And I would find out that, you know, they wanted to impress someone. You know, their mom always wanted them to be a lawyer. So they went to school and got their law degree and they did everything they were supposed to do, but they just were miserable, you know, or they just wanted things to be perfect. And I just wanted to bust those myths wide open so that they could see, not just in the course of our conversation, but also when the myths crept up again in the future, I wanted them to be aware of the scripts and the stories that they were telling themselves that weren't serving them. And so that's why I put it in the book, because I really wanted people to be able to almost coach themselves through scenarios that pop up.
I thought it was really beautifully written and powerful.
Thank you.
One of the things that you had written is that people close to you may not be able to hear the song only you were meant to sing.
Right.
And so helping people realize that even those who love you the most, who mm-hmm. are closest to you, may not be your partners in these exercises.
Exactly.
That you've actually got to get past and find this expertise on your own.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a great session. And then, so you're having them, then the next kind of set of values that I saw in this was embracing your inner expert
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
wrapping your head around it. And you gave very tactical ways of doing that. One of them that I thought was really interesting is, who do you help?
Mm-hmm.
How do you identify your audience?
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about the process that you go through to figure that out?
Mm-hmm. So it kind of goes back to the same process of finding those peak moments when you were doing work that you loved. Who were you doing it with and who were you doing it for? Because that can also kind of make the difference between it being a project that you absolutely love or just a project that's just okay. Right? You may love interviewing people for radio about their personal stories. And you may sit here and interview men, women, young, old, but you really come alive when you're talking to young women, right? Like, I want you to focus on that audience because that's when you're going to be able to do your very best work.
So we've only got a few minutes left,
okay.
But it sounds like what you're describing is a way of being strategic and intentional.
Yes.
Which, for me, taps into what I saw as the core concepts mm-hmm, that were mm-hmm. listed. So one of them is you are an expert.
Mm-hmm.
The other one was business development works best when you are strategic and intentional.
Yes.
Another one that you had in here is public speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Why is this important?
Public speaking is important because a stage, when you can speak in front of a group of people, there's no more powerful way to position your expertise. It's just powerful. It's one thing for me to talk to you and tell you, you know, something that I'm good at and explain a concept to you. But if I'm explaining the concept in front of a room of 200 people, it just elevates me in the consumer's mind and the audience's mind. And so the more that you can get out there and speak, the quicker you can build your brand.
And in doing so, I thought one of the great tips that you had to offer was have a talk.
Yes, yes, yes.
Which relates to being an expert.
Right, we all have a talk. Even if you don't think you have one, there's probably something that you share. There's probably a series of steps, a solution to a problem that you hear very often that you could detail three or four steps to and build that, you know, build a talk around that how-to solution.
And also the other how-to solutions that you have in here, and I thought this was a great message, especially for those of us who are late to the game. Social media is a set of tools that should make your life easier, not harder.
Yes. And it's an opportunity. I love social media because, as I mentioned earlier in the interview about the blog that I started, you know, it wasn't a chore for me. It was an opportunity for me to connect with people around the world. And never before had I had that chance to share my message with such a potentially infinite audience.
Well, and because we're short on time, tell me if my takeaways on social media strategy were useful.
Okay.
So one is that there's using LinkedIn and Facebook as a way of identifying people in your network so you can communicate with them.
Right.
But then also using it to get your message out to a bigger audience.
Right.
And then most of all, being relevant, bringing mm-hmm. your expertise to people so that it can make a difference.
Right.
Amanda, it has been inspiring and a pleasure to have you here on Women at Work. And if any of you would like to write in, give us a call, write in 1-844-WHARTON, 1-844-942-7866, and we'll get back to you next week with answers to your questions. Thanks so much. This has been Women at Work.